It's very lovely to have you here. It's not your first time in Yorkshire, is it? You've been to Yorkshire a few times?
Well, I have been here before. My father-in-law I think his grandma was born here. And he came about 3 years ago when I think one of our daughters was about to be born or just after. And we came here to see the house that she was born in and spent the day. There's not much to see in Hull, so we left after a few hours. There's a nice bridge there somewhere. I think that was it.
I'm sure.
Oh, and the Wilberforce Monument, but that was about it.
Yeah. I was going to take you to the museum. You weren't so keen on that.
Now, let me ask you. It's a nice day tomorrow.
Let me ask you a few questions about family and tell us about what you get up to these days and what your plans are for the future.
Well, at the moment, I'm married. I have a wife. Her name is Tara. We live in Taunton. We have two girls, Talika and Liana. Talika is our eldest. She's turning 5 in December. She's 4 and a bit. We have a young daughter called Liana, and she's 2.5. So that's the family from my sort of immediate family, if you will. And then I've got brothers and sisters, of course. But we'll be here all night if we go through that.
No, let's not do that. And I won't ask you how how your garden is or anything like that. Tell us about plans for the future. You're heading off, I think, aren't you? Is that right?
Yeah, we are. Well, Tara's folks are a little poorly. They're in their, at least, I think Dad's almost 70s. And the kids, obviously, having lived here, haven't spent enough time with them. And so we thought it's the right time to sort of head back home so that Tara can be closer to her relatives and also, obviously, let the grandkids get to know their grandparents because they're not going to be here forever. So it's also Talika's first year of school next year, and so we thought it's probably good to make everything just fit together.
But that's not Somerset. You're going from Somerset.
No. Did I not mention we're going to Australia? No, so, we're heading over. Tara's from Adelaide, so she's heading home, of course, and I'm going to settle there. I will be coming back and forth over the next few years, but in the immediate future, it's just a plan to settle down so the kids can go to school and get to know the family a bit more.
Cool. You're a man of many parts. Cricket has been what we've known you for over the years, but you do other things other than cricket. Tell us about photography. When did that sort of start off in your life?
Well, I guess it was back in high school. I think I was 15 or so when I asked my dad to buy me a camera. It was obviously back in the day with when you still had film, and he bought me a Minolta, I think. Not the greatest name, but it was a film camera, and it took great shots, good enough to document memories. And then, obviously, digital came along, and I then started to invest in all areas of photography, lenses and cameras. And then I got involved in videography, because if you fall in love with a still image, you sort of think, well, it would be nice to make films, short films and videos and stuff like that. And so that's branched out into cinematography. So, and the great thing about making films nowadays is quite easy if you spend a small budget on specific film gear. There are cameras that are coming out now that shoot in what's called RAW for a very modest price, £400-£500. There's a company from Australia called Blackmagic Design that are giving filmmakers like myself, wannabe filmmakers, if you will, the opportunity to be able to tell a story, and it'll look good projected on a big screen. So that's taken a decade or so to develop. I'm a singer. Used to take part in plays in school. So
just stay with the videos. What kind of videos are you making? What kind of short films?
I haven't made any yet.
It's happening soon.
Hopefully, yes. But the way I'm thinking is, I'm a singer, so I'll finish my songs, do the album, make the videos for the songs, and then learn how to make films from there. Because you really need to take, you need to walk, and then you can run. Making a feature film or a short film.
Yeah.
It's quite an involved process. So I think you need to learn the rudimentary aspects of lighting and angles and all that sort of stuff. So I'm just learning on the job so that I can do it myself instead of paying 10 grand to someone else.
Let me ask you a question about the portraits. When did they start? When did you begin to paint?
Well, I started painting in school. Again, probably age of 13, 14, oil paints. Got introduced to it by my art teacher. And just fell in love with it. I mean, it's messy. It takes a long time for them to dry. But I think there's something quite enjoyable that I derived from it, being able to almost represent something you see in nature or even in your mind and being able to put it on
a
canvas.
It's also a person. There's a picture of Richie Benner, isn't there?
At school I started landscapes, etc. And then I came to this country. And, of course, some of you may remember the tsunami appeal in 2000, I can't remember, four or five. It was over Boxing Day, wasn't it? Or Christmas, or New Year's Eve, I think. Anyway, for the MCC's Tsunami Appeal, I painted a portrait of Richie Beno. I don't think it was the first portrait I'd ever done, but it was one that I certainly let out into the wild, if you will. And then I did another one of Wazim Akram and a few others. So it's a passing interest. I did a headmaster recently as well, but it takes me like 2 years to finish one, so it's not something I do every day.
No, I can see that. Are you going to sing for us? Would you like to sing?
Is there a request?
Yes, please.
Would you love
to sing something for us. What are you going to sing for us?
I don't know. A song, maybe one that people might like. I hope you like the song. It's a song that made me recognize that Scottish people don't have a sense of humor. After the elections, they probably do now. So I need to clarify, just in case I get thrown out. What it was I thought, I went on a tour of Scotland about 2 years ago. It was deep in the heart of winter. And the minister who'd invited me was taking me around a lot of churches. He took me to a prison as well. I wasn't locked up. I was visiting the prison. And universities, churches, schools, that sort of thing. So I was there for a week. And while I was there, I realized how cold some of the audiences are to start with. They generally are slow to warm up. And by that, I mean just general ambience. I don't mean that they're cold by nature. It's just people don't know what to make of you when you first walk in the room, that sort of thing. So I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll use a bit of tongue-in-cheek. I'll tell a gag to make them warm up. So I said, I'm going to sing a song that you love to sing at your Scottish rugby matches, you know, the big Six Nations matches that you all sing with great pride. And this was tongue-in-cheek, again, I will say. I said I was going to sing the song Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. I don't think they understand tongue-in-cheek up there. I've never been invited again, so I don't have a sense of humor up there. Don't get too smug. You barely meet them here in Hong Kong. Anyway, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. A bit more volume, Harry, come on. No, that's too much. That's better.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Do you remember where you first came across that song?
No, I don't, actually. It was probably high school, I'm sure. I think there was a World Cup, and I think it was held either here in England or in New Zealand, Australia. And, of course, Kiri...
Kitanawa.
That's the one. I was always going to start with a K. Kitanawa. she was on this album in which she sung the song World in Union. Do you remember that? And I think Swing Low was on there. I could be stretching my memory here, but I think that's where I might have first heard it.
As you sang it, you love it. We can see that you love it. What is it about it that you really love as you think about the song?
Well, it's a great song with a great message, and of course, I think it's got special significance for people who have a spiritual look at life. There's obviously a day when we will step out of this mortal coil, if you will, and there's a moment that's guaranteed for all human beings when we have to face death. And clearly, this song speaks to people who have hope that there's something better to look forward to on the other side. And of course, as a believer in Christ and in God, I think that gives it a little bit more meaning to me than a rugby anthem.
Sure.
There's a depth to it.
Home is a great way of putting that, isn't it?
Yes, no, absolutely. We're just a passing through, as they say. Yeah. Yeah.
Take me right back to your home, how you started, where you were born and brought up. Go away from today, right back to when did Henry appear in the world and where?
Well, born in Zambia in 1976, I was born in Lusaka, the capital city. My mom was Zimbabwean. She was a nurse. She met my dad, who was a doctor in the same hospital. They fell in love. They had my brother, Victor, who's 2 years older than me. He's actually always been 2 years older than me. And and then I was born in 76. And then we moved to Kenya, spent a couple of years there, and then moved.
Why Kenya?
Well, Dad's Kenyan, so they decided to go back
there
for just a very short while, maybe 2 years or so. And then the marriage fell apart when my mom decided she wanted to go home. She was Zimbabwean, like I said, and so she ended up going to Harare, the capital city. Yeah. And my dad settled in Bulawayo, which was like this, it's not the second largest city, but sort of is. So kind of like the Birmingham of
Zimbabwe. Where were you? Which were you with?
Who
were
you with? Well, we ended up mainly predominantly with dad, but then he sent us off to boarding school when I turned 8. So in the end, it was kind of almost equal because I'd spent 2 weeks of the holidays with mom and 2 weeks with dad and then off to school for 3 months and repeat the process every 3 months.
How far was school from home?
Well, school initially in junior school was 32 kilometers away. Excuse me, I can't do metric or whatever, imperial, so do the math. 20 miles, yeah, I yeah, suppose, yeah. At a guess. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then
and you boarded
high
from
school
eight.
Was
you
100 boarded, kilometers.
You boarded from 8?
I boarded from 8 all the way till 18. So, yeah, effectively, what, 11 years of my life as a boarder.
Yeah. How was that?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, tough from the perspective of the fact that, you know, I was miles away from home and didn't really get to know my family that well. And in fact, to this day, I think anyone who's been to boarding school that long kind of resonates with the sentiment I'm trying to give, that you form really strong bonds with your schoolmates, of course, because you're spending 24/7 with them for 9 months of every year for quite a while. And so, you know, 5 years of junior school and 6 years of high school, and eventually, you know, you form bonds that are really unbreakable. So I will say that was the tough side, but the good side was I fell in love with a lot of things in boarding school because there's a lot of time on your hands, and we didn't have PlayStations or computers to mess around with, so you immersed yourself in school activities. So there was sport. I loved my sport. I could run. Being half Kenyan, that was never going to be a problem, running.
so quick running or long-distance running? Or
the quick stuff. Long-distance running is painful. So I thought, if you're going to feel pain, do it for 10 seconds. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So you're quite quick.
So I was quick over 100 meters and 200 meters, and I used to do the 4x100 meters relay as well. Threw the javelin, did a little bit of long jump and a bit of high jump as well. But ultimately, my view was to try and sort of go to the Olympics. I was inspired by Daley Thompson and Carl Lewis in the mid-80s.
You'd be a decathlete, right?
Yeah, that's what I wanted. That's what my goal was. But, of course, I fell in love with other sports as well. But the good thing about running is you can transfer it from any sport to another, you know, one to another. So you can go from football to rugby. If you can run, they just give you the ball like Rooney and tell you to go and score. and I'm referring to proper sports, by the way, not British pastimes like darts or snooker. Proper sports.
I was about to ask, have we got to a sport you didn't like?
Swimming.
Swimming.
I was rubbish at swimming. But it's been scientifically proven that black people have heavier bones than white people. That's why you'll never see a black man in the 100 meters freestyle final. So that's my excuse anyway.
I was going to say you believe that. Absolutely.
That's my excuse. So I was rubbish at swimming, but most sports that had, you know, eye-hand, ball skills,
you could
right
do
up my
those.
Alley. I loved them. I played a little bit of tennis,
but
it was really football, rugby, cricket. Football fell away when I got to high school because it clashed with rugby.
Okay.
The practice times were the same and the match days were the same, so
Choice.
I played rugby.
Yeah.
I played rugby.
And what position?
Well, I moved around. I started off as fly half, then I got moved to outside or inside center, I can't remember, and then I was on the wing for the province. So
The running thing.
Yes, the running thing. Give Henry the ball, run, you know. And I didn't like those big burly guys from the opposition who were props or locks, so I thought, let me just go on the wing further from danger. And so sport was my thing. And then obviously when I started to get to the end of my schooling, there was some serious murmurs about my potential to maybe make the national side. So I started to focus on cricket a bit more.
Yeah.
And then my athletics coach left the school when I in my 16th year. Or if not my 16th year, my 17th year. That's your lower 6th year. And I guess with him leaving, he was my mentor. He was the guy who got me running great times. I was running 10.6 at the age of 16 in the 100 meters, which is a good time. And so there was promise. But with him leaving, I lost the impetus to get up and train as hard as you need to. And so my cricket coach took me under his wing, and he gave me a new dream, which was, hey, you can play for the country in Test cricket if you work hard enough.
So just looking back to that, what did he see in you, and what did he do with the talent that was there? How did he shape?
My athletics coach or cricket?
No,
coach?
The cricket one. Now that you leave athletics behind, going to cricket.
My cricket coach knew that I was quick. I was a fast bowler. I could bowl, you know, at my peak. I don't know how fast I bowled at school, but at my peak, I could bowl 92, 93 miles an hour. So that was, it's a rare thing to find a bowler who can bowl that fast. So he saw the raw talent, and I have to say, boy, it was raw, because I was very inaccurate. They used to say of me that The ball could go anywhere when I let it go.
I think your Test career started with a very interesting opening ball, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It was four wides down the leg. So that wouldn't have surprised anyone who watched me at school, though. Like I said, they used to say I didn't know where the ball was going when I bowled. But I thought, if I don't know where the ball's going, how will the batsman know? So just let it go. So I was fast, and that's what the talent scouts identified, the selectors.
I mean, you're not hugely tall the way they are these days. What was it that made you quick?
I think it's the athleticism. Yeah. I think, if you think historically about fast bowlers, they're either tall.
Yeah.
You think of Joel Garner, you think of Curtly Ambrose. I'm thinking of West Indies because they made giants. Curtly Ambrose, Courtney Walsh. In this country, Flintoff. Even Broad and Anderson, they're not short guys, are they? So that they have a mechanical advantage, and the ball's coming from a height, and it gives them a bit of bounce. But I wasn't. So they don't have to be fast. No. They just have to get on a good length, McGrath, and get it to bounce a little. I didn't have that. I was a skiddy bowler, but I was quick. Yeah. So where they had bounce as an advantage, I rushed batsmen. So batsmen didn't have as much time when they were facing me.
Yeah.
So at 93, 94 miles an hour, you're giving the batsman 0.23 of a second to react or something like that. Whereas, someone who's bowling at 140, maybe it's 0.4 of a second, 0.5. So it's just... So that little fraction of a second makes a difference.
Yeah. And as that was set before you, what was your reaction to that? I mean, you were ambitious to achieve that goal of playing for the country, were you? From what sort of age?
I kind of found myself kind of led into it. I wouldn't say that from the age of six I wanted to play for my country. I mean, that Test cricket was something that came along when I was about 14 or 15. Mm. Zimbabwe, prior to that, had been an international country playing one days only. Yeah. And then in 92, when I was 16, Zimbabwe got test status. So test status was something that wasn't available to me, so I didn't grow up as a kid thinking, I want to play test cricket for Zimbabwe. Sure. As would happen here in this country, with a legacy of role models like Botham and, Lily, at least Dilly, and all the other cricketers you can think of, fast bowlers. And so I kind of found myself thrust into cricket and doors opening for me, if that makes sense. Mm. So I just kept playing for my province, for my school side. Then I got picked to play for the province for the men's side. Mm. And then lo and behold, I wrote my exams in December. And by January, February, I was picked to make my debut against Pakistan. It was just, I guess, door after door opening and people wanting me because I had this one thing no one else had, which was speed. And speed is like any other bowling discipline, you've got to have something. A spinner who spins the ball is valuable. Think of Shane Warne. A fast bowler who can rush batsmen, good batsmen, is valuable as well. So we didn't have any fast bowlers. We had fast medium and medium bowlers. And so I was, even though I was raw and expensive, they felt it was worth a gamble. So I made my debut against Pakistan in January, February.
What kind of background training was going on? Were you having to run 30 miles a week and all that kind of stuff and stay off the chips?
No. Zim was very amateur in the early days. A lot of players who were playing for the national side at the time were playing club cricket in England. So I'm sure they had a rudimentary understanding of what was required to be a professional sportsman. But I was straight out of school. And our school system wasn't... full of elite training. We were just cricketers who got fit by bowling and playing. And you can imagine how much success I had at schoolboy level. It might have given me a rather warped view of what playing with men was like, because I had a lot of success playing against boys.
You took a lot of wickets,
And then I come in, and now I'm playing against seasoned professionals, people like Saeed Anwar and Salim Malik, and it was a different ball game then.
So somebody with raw talent, who knows he's quick, who knows he can rush batsmen, what are you looking for in a coach? What would you want the coach to help you with?
Well, I would have loved a coach who prevented me from being called for throwing, for a start. That's the first thing. But I grew up at a time when cricket was in a state of transition. And I had a problem with my action. And actually, I got called in my first test match and I had to go and address it over a number of years. It took me 3 years to remodel my action and fix it. Nowadays, it's there's a different protocol if a bowler's got a... what's deemed to be an illegal action. But back then, they were just...
And had no one noticed it before? Or
they'd noticed it. What could they do about it? It's not like we had universities that could measure how many degrees of flexion. In fact, back in the day, you didn't even have that leniency. If the umpire thought you were throwing, they just called you.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have known technically what was going wrong. I'd been coached by many people who were dare I say it, unqualified. They were well-meaning and well-intentioned, but they would come to me and they'd say, you know, get your left leg as high as you can, turn a bit more side on. And so I'd do everything they suggested to me, but that caused me to have what's called a mixed action, and that led to the technical problems. It wasn't as if I was wanting to throw, it was just mechanically, if you're trying to bowl there and your leg goes there, you end up having to swivel to end up bowling the ball there, and that's when the bent elbow comes in.
And it took you 3 years to undo that.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I played played the test match in 95, got called then, but I went to India in 95, worked with Dennis Lilly then. In 96, I played another one-day international. So it's not as if I was in the wilderness for 3 years, but I did get sent all over the world. I went to Australia in 96, and then I went to South Africa in 97 and worked again with good people there, Clive Rice in South Africa and a few others. So that ended with me being... I mean, there was never an official paper that said, Henry Longo is now legal. It was just my arm got straighter and no one sort of raised the issue again. And I had a pretty decent, healthy career for, 5 years after. So I played from 95 through to 2003 when I retired.
Okay. Well, and what's the sort of atmosphere to be a cricketer in Zimbabwe? As others look on and see cricket, does that give you a sort of passport to all kinds of places that others can't get to? What kind of impact does being a cricketer have on your life in the country?
Well, the first thing I'll say is prior to sort of the mid-90s, cricket was a very elite sport. You know, unless you'd gone to a school that played it, and there were very few that did. It's kind of similar to, I guess, what rugby was like here in this country. Rugby was pretty much a public school thing, am I correct? I'm guessing. Not a lot of sort of state schools would play it. But
that's probably right.
Is that a fair comparison?
I think it depends which coach you're talking about. But that's
So anyway, in Zim, not a lot of kids had access to cricket simply because it was more something that the elite schools played because they had, you need a field, you need stumps. These things all cost money, and you need people who are competent of the rules. You need kit. Everyone needs kit, pads, bats, everything. And all of that costs money. So there's already an economic barrier to a lot of people playing. We are talking about Africa here where people are barely able to pay school fees. So automatically, a lot of people thought, oh, that's not our sport. We love football. Because with football, anyone can play. You get a cheap ball. You don't even need boots. You put a couple of bricks up. You got your goals. Yeah. And anyone can play football. So most of the country, I'd say, would back football. So, you know, fast forward through to the, late 90s, and we started to have success. So we came to the World Cup here in 99, did pretty well, got through to the Super 6 stage. So out of 10 or 12 tests, there were 10 test-playing nations, and out of the 12 nations that were there, because I think Scotland was there and a few others, we got through the last six. So for little old Minnow Zimbabwe, really that was good. Amazing. England didn't even get through. So you can imagine us going back to Zim, and everyone thinks that cricket's great. Yeah. And so we had the president on board, we had people on board, we had people starting to recognize us, and that did change our lives. And then we started to demand to get paid more fairly and squarely, and we were then able to become professionals. Because up until then, we were glorified amateurs, really.
You weren't paid a living wage?
Hardly. I mean, the same as Scotland or Ireland, really. So unless you played cricket here, for a county or club cricket who played you well, you were playing for the honor of playing for your country. And that, you know, the people with families and kids. And
doesn't pay the bills.
So it doesn't, correct. But things changed then, and then perception changed, and people wanted to play cricket. And I was the first black player, by the way, to play for Zimbabwe. So I was at the front of a wave of players that came after me, and people saw me as a role model, leading the way for all the other people. So obviously once a number of other black players started to make the side, people started to say, hey, it's not such a bad sport. Looks, one of us is playing, or a few of our people are playing, and that so inspiration possible. Began, and then a few younger players like Tatenda Taibu and Masakadze and a few others came through. And some of them played in the last World Cup that just happened a month or so ago. And they're now people who are known, but they were little boys when I was making my debut. So I was at the front of that wave.
So you had a voice like that.
Well, it was kind of far off as a desire, really. I left out of every play in junior school, including The Sound of Music. So you've got to be pretty poor to get left out of The Sound of Music. It's a part for everybody. So when I got to high school, I thought, you know what? I've got a clean slate here. No one knows who I am. I'm just going to go for the audition and hope that someone notices my voice.
You just told them you could sing. Is that right?
Well, the audition was free for entry. Anyone who wanted to be in the play could come. So I went. There was a lady called Felix Westwood. She'd been at our school for 30-odd years. She got us all to sing individually and as a group.
And after I sung, as my solo did, she wrote my name down. I thought, yes, that's got to be a good sign, right? Yeah. She wrote my name down. She told us to look at the notice board a few days later to see whether we're involved in the, whether we'd been picked in the play or not. I went to the notice board. I noticed the first thing that wiped the smile off my face, which was that the play we were doing that year was called Oklahoma. Now, if you know anything about plays and theatre and productions, that's one of them old plays. You can do them in a century ago or so. Yeah. So
cowgirls and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So the second thing was I was a cowgirl. Boys only school, boy with a high-pitched voice, I made it as a cowgirl. We did about three or four performances, maybe more, and after the final performance, we were taking our makeup off. You can imagine how much makeup they had to put on me to make me look like a girl. But when they... This lady, Phoenix, was taking my makeup off, and she couldn't stop giggling. And I said, what's so funny, man? She said, well, Longa, you're categorically the ugliest girl we've ever had in any play. She watched a lot of plays. So that's my introduction to...
That's great. Great. That's great.
But I thought, you know what? I'm not going to be a girl ever again in a play.
Yeah.
So the next year, I went for the auditions, and I wanted to be Marco. I went for a principal part.
Yeah.
And I was Marco in The Gondoliers, which is one of the old plays again, Gilton Song. And I was one of two brothers, Marco. Giuseppe's supposed to be my brother in the play, or is my brother in the play, I think. And they'd already cast him. He was 6 foot tall and white, so I've no idea how we were brothers. But hey, in Africa, you do what you got.
Yeah.
Just so then I sung there. I took on another play. So I was Frederick in the Pirates of Penzance.
Yeah.
And the narrator in Joe's been a Technicolor Dreamcoat. And from there, of course, doors opened, and I was invited to sing in the choir. Christmas carols, I was...
Were you coached?
Well, obviously, if I'm singing a solo part in a play, I would go and see Mrs. Westwood, and she...
She was the one.
Say, oh, you know, a bit more stomach, or, you know, project a bit more through your nasal cavity, or whatever, you know, all the little tips you pick up as you grow. And so, from there, so that was the most of it at school. Then I worked with another lady called Shirley Smith, who was at the big city girls' school, and I was doing...
You were playing a part of a girl again? Or
no. No, this time I was singing in a concert. They were raising money for a charity, and they asked me to sing something from Messiah.
Yeah.
So I sung Comfort Ye and Every Valley Shall Be Exalted.
Yes.
And so that gave me, I guess, the idea that perhaps I could do this kind of music. And of course, I've left out an important bit, which was in 1990, I was the three tenors singing.
Uh-huh.
That wonderful concert that was in Italy, I think, before the World Cup. And when I heard them sing, I thought, well, I'd love to sing like that. And rewinding even further back, in that play, Oklahoma, there was, excuse me, a man called Mark Green. Mm-hmm. So I was a junior in school, I was Form 1, or your first year of high school, 13 years old. And this guy was a senior, he was in his last year, not a six, he was 18, and he was about to leave. But he had the most beautiful tenor voice. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you talk about role models or being inspired by someone. He was the guy I thought, wow, man, I'd love to sing like that. And so, you know, as luck would have it, I looked in the mirror, I sort of tried to mouth how he mouthed stuff. I would go, oh, that doesn't sound right. Oh, you know.
Do you sing from Oklahoma? Do you sing those songs? I can hear them in my head while you're talking about them.
Well, it's funny you ask. I don't sing them anymore. And of course, I only knew the girls' chorus, but I do know, oh, what a beautiful morning.
Yeah.
In fact, I went to the Amazon a few weeks ago and just binged on some of these old films.
Yeah.
You guys have heard of Blu-ray, right? I don't want to be patronizing, but Blu-ray gives you just amazing quality. And they've reissued a lot of the old films, like
in Blu-ray.
Me in St. Louis. Anyone know that one?
Some
of the oldies know what I'm talking about,
right?
Judy Garland, and I bought An American in Paris, in Oklahoma as well. So we've got it in what's called CinemaScope. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Widescreen.
And do you pick out the cowgirl that was you? Do you pick that one out? No, you don't.
No, they didn't crop this, and I didn't have people like me there. So it was wonderful. But it's a wonderful production. And I'm actually thinking of doing a CD.
Yeah,
at some point in the future.
I think you should. Someone said to me that when you began to sing, her hairs on her arm were kind of just raised by the kind of way.
In a good way or a...
I think it was good. I think she meant it was good. She really did. She was good. And again, just take back to that song, thinking, 9 o'clock. Yeah, it's striking. Yeah. Can you hear it?
Lovely.
Yeah. We like it too. You sang the Lord's Prayer to us. If there was a phrase in the Lord's Prayer that you kind of wanted to underline, which would it be, as you think back to that? Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I think I have an answer, and it's a strange one, the phrase that I've made, but it's clearly, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. I think it's probably the hardest of the lines there, because it's so easy for us to want forgiveness when we've messed up. I mean, everyone in this room knows when they've messed up and they've got to go and grovel to someone and, "I'm so sorry, I messed up, please forgive me." But we're not so keen on dishing it out, are we, on the whole forgiveness thing? And of course, it's kind of a reminder of the relationship we have with God. I mean, somewhere in the Bible, one of the Gospels, we're encouraged to make peace with our brother. If he's offended us, we make peace with him first before we go and pray to God. The whole notion of being at peace with your fellow man is something that God holds quite highly in esteem. You know, there's another little story that Jesus tells about a guy who's owed a debt and he can't pay it, and he begs for forgiveness, he's forgiven. And then he goes and he finds someone else who owes him a debt, and he, you know, demands his payment back. And really, the gist of the story there is, if you want God to forgive you, you've got to forgive your fellow man. That's a tough thing to do.
Yeah.
But I think I'm always reminded when I sing that song, actually, whenever I get to that line, I'm like, wow, this is deep. Because it really is.
It is difficult, yeah. Let me pick up just in terms of headline terms. I'm going to talk about this again tomorrow night at some length. There was a particular episode that we know of in your life where you were under a lot of pressure and you put on a black armband. Just give us that headline news of what was that about? Why did you do that? And then we'll talk about it properly tomorrow.
Okay, in a nutshell, there's a man called Robert Mugabe. He came to power in Zimbabwe in 1980, taking over from the old leader, Ian Smith. He's been in power since 1980. So my maths is right, it's 35 years.
Yeah, yeah.
A long time. During that period of time, he's done a lot of nasty things to people. I won't go into detail tonight, but that resulted in myself and Mr. Flower, who was a former coach of England, if you follow him, to protest against a lot of things. Not just stuff that happened in the early 80s, like human rights abuses, but also farm invasions. I'm sure you've heard of those maybe 13 years ago. There's been a lot of corruption in the country. So a lot of things that, again, we'll unpackage tomorrow night, but couple of things, my Christian conviction got me to that place, and also my political awareness.
Yeah.
And of course, my sense of social justice as well.
I see that.
Those were all compelling things that got me to a place where I said, you know what, I'm a cricketer, I've got a long career ahead of me, but there's a bigger picture here.
Yeah.
Let's try and tell the world.
How do you bring that together with the Lord's Prayer then? Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors.
Well, you know, from my perspective, of course, I don't hold Mugabe as a debtor to me.
No, I see that.
Obviously, God is his judge and he'll deal with that again, But I guess, you know, I think of South Africa, and actually we've got a South African in the back. How about South Africa? I've forgotten her name, but it's a really long name. I won't even try and say it. But South Africa is a key country with regards to reconciliation. And they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I believe, put together by Desmond Tutu, was a very important part of that. Then obviously there's a lot of stuff that went down in South Africa, and many hurts, many people were brutally hurt, tortured, traumatized. But for South Africa to move forward, they had to have this Truth and Reconciliation Commission where people, victims, could meet their, I suppose, alleged perpetrators and have a dialogue of some sort. And no one was going to be thrown in prison or anything, but just, hey, this is what you did to me.
Yeah.
And the person was given the opportunity to say, I'm sorry. I wish we'll have something like that in Zimbabwe.
You haven't had that.
We haven't. A lot of the wounds that have been inflicted on people are still raw. There's never been an apology from the government for a lot of the atrocities they've committed. So hopefully that'll happen. But I guess from a wider sort of picture, I guess there is the notion, however, that if you don't learn this issue of forgiveness, God will hold you to account.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Christian message is that God is loving, is forgiving, is full of grace, is compassionate. But, you know, if you turn down the opportunity to deal with issues of offense and where you've hurt people and traumatized other people, God will hold you accountable to that. And so Robert Mugabe and I suppose everyone else, all of us have to deal with that issue of what happens when we die? Do we have a creator God we have to give an account to or not? And I suggest that in the interest of cosmic justice, it would be wrong for someone like Mugabe or Hitler or anyone else to get away with it.
I see that. Okay, more of that tomorrow night.